Senate Committee on the Judiciary, Tuesday, June 22nd, 1999, 7:30 a.m. here in Room B.
And welcome to the Senate Judiciary. We have a couple bills up today where the amendments are not ready. One is HJR 52, so we'll reschedule that for Thursday at 7:30 a.m. for those that are here. And then on HJR 2, we won't reschedule that. There aren't some votes on the committee to pass that. So then on... On HB 2985, amendments on that are not ready either, so we'll schedule for Thursday. All right, so we'll try Thursday on H 2985. Okay, and then the final one that's amendments not ready to this morning are on HB 3388. And we'll reschedule that one on Thursday at 7:30. Then at 8 o'clock, Senator Brown has to go to a caucus meeting, and some of us have to go to a very brief conference committee at 8 a.m. in hearing room E. So we probably will be in recess for a few minutes. The conference will only take about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back. But we can do a couple things this morning before that happens. And we'll begin then with HB 3492. Our work session on House Bill 3492.
Mr. Chair, members, if you remember, this bill aligns state law with the federal cigarette labeling and advertising act. And these amendments that are before you, the dash A11, Mr. Gardner referenced during his testimony at your hearing. The amendments, I believe, were at the request of the retailers and distributors, and they provide timelines for required notices issued by the Department of Revenue regarding the effect of the measure itself and the date up to which any penalties could be imposed or destruction or sale of cigarettes could take place. And they add an emergency clause effective October 1st.
I think we're ready to move those amendments.
I'm moving the amendments to 3492-33-11A11 amendments.
Senator Courtney moves dash A11 amendments to House Bill 3492. Any other discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none, the order.
Move House Bill 3492 as an amendment to the recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3492 as amended to the floor with a due pass of a recommendation. Discussion? Objection? The word. Carry it, please. Oh, carry. Thank you. Alright. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 3630.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill establishes the WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children Program in VHR, and Actually, it's in statute, and the amendments, as you heard from the Health Division at your hearing, the HB amendments had an emergency clause. The division desires to become effective sooner than October 1st, or at least by October 1st.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Moves the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 3630. Discussion?
We were all right with this slowly. We didn't need even earlier date, did we? That's good. Remember, we had that discussion.
The testimony of Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, was that they would want it effective October 1st, so it does make it earlier. It's up to you.
Okay, I just know that that's fine. We got over here that little question.
But October 1 is all right with them?
Yeah. I think so. Okay. That was at the fast Thursday hearing when the fuel was here with cookies.
Glad you like that, Senator. Now tell me.
Rice sugar and cookies.
Senator Tarno, did that sway your vote in any way?
You like the cookies? I don't see no cookies.
I'd like a maple
early.
Right now.
There you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have a motion? Not any relevant debate on is there an objection? Hearing none. Senator Brown.
I move the bill to the floor as amended for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves HB 3630 to the floor for due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion. Objection. Senator Brown, would you carry?
I'd be delighted.
Thank you. Did we ever have a hearing on the bill? Did Courtney, did you hear 3044?
No, we didn't.
I'll remind Mr. Lashman then.
What happened in that?
Have a public hearing on this bill?
Yes.
No, sir. Well, why don't you talk to us about it?
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLice, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Correctional Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. This bill actually had a whole series and was pretty much reworked on the House side from its original version. Let me indicate to you that in the current version that it's in right now, it's passed the House 57-1. That was, as I indicated, after some extensive discussions on the outside between the State Health Division and the State Court Administrator's Office to figure out process, how to expedite the process of testing for hepatitis B and C and HIV of potential source persons who have exposed public safety officers. The bill, the way it came over, was the best thought process of those three bodies, myself, along with the Health Division and the State Court Administrators, and how to do this in expedited fashion that allows the public safety officer who has the potential exposure to get the test started quickly, get the results back as quickly as possible, so that they can, in fact, go on with their lives. Let me back up a little bit. And the original problem that you have that led to this bill is an issue that public safety officers are exposed to bodily fluids on a regular basis. In some cases, it's accidental. In some cases, it's very intentional. What we're talking about here is a very small portion of the exposures. What happens typically in most cases is if there's a substantial exposure, and the public safety officer has or believes there's a risk of exposure, what they typically do is immediately go to a health care provider. It may be a nurse practitioner, it may be an MD, it may be a physician assistant in a rural area. At that point, that provider will make an initial assessment and say, usually that day, yes, we believe you have a substantial exposure. The fact that you didn't have your space flash glasses on, or that you had an open wound yourself and that there was blood there, indicates that you may in fact have a substantial exposure, and we believe that the source person needs to be tested. Second step usually is that you ask either at the site when the initial exposure or sometime within that first 24 hours, you're asking the source person if they consent to have their blood tested. Done confidentially, it's usually provider to provider. It's always provider to provider, and it's confidential. And the results come back and say no problem, then the person goes along on with their life. At the same time, this is all occurring, the public safety officer, in almost all cases, if there's an initial judgment that there's been a substantial exposure, will go on what's called a cocktail, a drug cocktail. And it's been found that if you go on these very heavy dosages, interferon and some other drugs, that in fact you may in fact be able to fight off the hepatitis B or C from the onset or minimize its impact. And the same is true with HIV. So the issue here is how quickly can you get tests, and then what's the length of period that you're going to have to be on the drug cocktail, which has some very severe side effects, before you know the end result, and then you know either you have to stay on that drug cocktail because there was an exposure, or that the source person is clean, that you can in fact go off that drug cocktail. The current situation is that the health division does have rules. It's not an expedited hearing process, and we've been told it takes anywhere from 3 weeks to maybe up to 6 weeks for this process to run. Well, what you're asking a public safety officer who has been exposed is to go on this very invasive process for anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. Besides the physical impact or impact of this, the emotional impact of not knowing whether you've been exposed or not is very dramatic. It's not an everyday situation that these types of cases have to go through, but the ones that I've heard about have been pretty traumatic. So that's why we introduced the bill. There are A5 amendments. The concept of what appears to be less than ex parte hearing was discussed on the House side in the committee and was rejected for the expedited process. What they attempted to do in our discussions with the committee over there with the state court administrators to set up a process that's basically the equivalent to a search warrant. That's an expedited process that you have to have probable cause to believe that there's been a substantial exposure. That has to be, not in all cases, but the bill does read in language that says you've gone to a healthcare provider and the healthcare provider believes there's been a substantial exposure. Let me back up just a minute. There is one little wiggle room there. There's no healthcare provider that's available. You can still go ahead with the petition. So that's why it's not an absolute requirement that you have that healthcare provider say there's been substantial exposure. We have concerns with the A5s. We'd like to build the way it is right now. The A5s need a particular shelter with all reasonable means to serve notice. Well, that puts the burden for the service on the petitioner themselves. I've been told that the time frame when it starts ticking may run anywhere from that very day to several weeks. There is a piece in here that says, well, after 48 hours, you can go ahead with an ex parte hearing. We're concerned about the process, though, itself, and any potential delay. If the court can, in fact, take up the petition the very first day, which is the way the original bill was, that's best for the public safety officer. At the very least, time frame under the A5s would be 3 days and potentially longer than that before we can start it. And then you have to also understand that the blood is drawn to get the test results may in fact take up to a week after that. So we're now talking 3 days plus a week, we're talking 10 days right from the get-go. We would strongly urge you to adopt the bill in its present form. The A5 concept was discussed in the House side and rejected.
To me, the A5s, the idea came from members of the House Judiciary Civil, one, Judy Overlaw, who was the one no vote on the floor for the bill, and the other was Wayne Shetterly, who supported the bill, but asked us to take a look at the notice requirement. This chair doesn't know how to use the notice requirement to make it work within the time frame of the bill. So, I don't think I support the A5s as they're presently drafted, but I'm open to other suggestions or ideas if anyone has any.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Is there another bill out there? There's another bill, isn't there? It actually came through my Ways and Means Subcommittee, and I was supposed to carry it. Where is that bill, and would that be a better approach?
Actually, I think Senator Burdick, I think what you're talking about is the bill that was introduced dealing with the victims of crime that represented Barbara Ross's. And it has, my understanding, it has basically the same process. I don't know that it's substantially different. It's an expedited process.
Chairman, if I can just follow, my recollection is that they had a similar amendment drafted for that bill, but if the amendment simply said that you had to ask the person first, and if they refused, then you just went ahead and got the test. So we just go through that. That didn't seem as cumbersome as this.
Senator Bryant, Senator Brink, that in essence is how this bill works too. This bill only kicks in if the person says no. So the first step of the process that I indicated was that you ask the person about the exposure. And if they consent, then you go about your life. You wouldn't have it tested. This only kicks in if they say no. And what usually happens, the type of situations we're talking about here are not typical citizens. We're talking about body fluid cocktails that are thrown at correctional officers. We're talking about other fluids that are intentionally public safety officers exposed to, whether it's in a pat-down, there's a needle in somebody's pocket, you ask the person, do you have a needle in your pocket, am I safe patting you down? They say, yeah, you're fine, knowing that you're probably going to stick yourself if you've not taken every precaution. And then you ask them and they say, no, I will not voluntarily give blood. So that's when this kicks in.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, just a final question. If would it make any sense to wrap both situations into one bill? And if that were true, would you prefer this approach or that approach? If that's what I mean.
Senator Bryant, Senator Burdick, I don't have any problems with the combination of bills. I'm not aware that the other bill is in trouble. If the intent is to try and put both bills together so that the other bill goes through, I'm not aware that's got a particular problem.
You have a problem probably with the relating clause. So I think the other one, just the relating clause is testing for disease at the request of the public safety officer.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I imagine the other relating clause is the crime victim.
Yeah, I was just thinking more in terms of process. If we're doing this process, it might make sense to have the same process.
And again, Mr. Chair, I believe the process of the net is in essence is the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I think we're ready to move the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3044. Not as amended, right?
No, just as is.
As the form of the two-pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3044 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Objection is ordered. Senator, would you hear it?
Thank you.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will now be in recess. Just be on the safe side. Well, you're in the quorum, aren't you? Who else has conference committee?
I don't know.
Well, Senator Brownstone, I think I'd like to be here for the remainder of the agenda this morning. So I do trust you up here.
Thank you. So I'm looking for you this morning.
We'll be in recess till 8:20. Just to make sure. Okay, the chair now offers when we have the key roll. For the early morning meeting. This is
a great chair.
Isn't this wonderful? Doesn't that make you feel better than cookies?
Yeah.
In the afternoon?
Yeah.
The cookies are broken, I understand. Yeah. Did you get a discount for those?
Yeah.
How much did you pay for your cookies?
I didn't pay for them.
You don't understand what's going on. It's just rivalry between the chair and the co-chair, or the love of their committee.
Look, I understand that this is to keep the peace and the frivolity.
Oh, yeah. It's late in the session, we're all tired and grumpy, so this is good to have a sense of humor as we committee, we had one additional amendment on a bill we passed out today, so having voted on the prevailing side, I serve notice of possible reconsideration and move for immediate reconsideration of House Bill 3492. Discussion? Objection supported. We now have before us and on reconsideration a vote by which we passed House Bill 3492 to the floor of the passed recommendation. To my motion, the additional amendment, I think you now have the information that was passed out in the 810s. And Mr. Nelson, would you speak to these? It deals with making it an offense to attempt to buy cigarettes and distraction.
Nelson. Mr. Sherman.
You are Mr.
Nelson. My name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Council, representing 7-Eleven. The amendments before you today would make it illegal for a minor to attempt to purchase or acquire tobacco products. Approximately 6 years ago, the grocery industry supported the effort to set up a sting operation within grocery stores, a process by which the state would ask use minors in a sting operation to see if clerks were selling. We have participated in that for 6 years. There has been some agreement, some disagreement in that process. We believe very strongly that it would be very, very helpful in the effort to curb minors' use of tobacco products if we had a process by which it would be illegal for a minor to attempt to purchase. Currently, it's illegal for a person to possess tobacco products, but it is not illegal for them to attempt to purchase. We provided you also a copy of ORS 471-430, which outlines the same similar process barring a minor from purchasing, attempting to purchase alcohol products. And we have mirrored that language in the Dash 10 amendments, and we believe that this would be very, very effective in curbing minors' possession. We think it's an issue of responsibility. We believe that the owners of stores, such as 7-Eleven, have the responsibility to train and educate their servers or their clerks not to sell, and a process by which we require the identification and the carding of minors to present the purchase of tobacco products. We believe there is a responsibility on the part of the clerk with that training to enforce that process. But we also believe that an individual who walks in, a minor who walks into a store with false identification, for example, presents that identification and attempts to purchase, should have some responsibility in that act. As such, we recommend to you the Dash 10, which again mirrors exactly what we are doing on the alcohol side when a minor attempts to purchase alcohol. Thank you very much.
As part of the penalty, a judge can order the suspension of the driving privileges of the minor not to exceed 1 year, and he can put any conditions he wants on it. He can say a month, review it, just like in the alcohol.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And, of course, can also impose a fine. Is there any fiscal that would have to be considered in adopting this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of.
Because they'd be before the court anyway on some sort of a violation.
It would be in, Mr. Chairman, they would be in court on a violation of possession.
Questions for Mr. Nelson?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes, I got it.
The only concern I have, and I know the driver's license is a good whip to use, but a former sheriff might be able to respond to this too. I'm always a little bit concerned because I'm afraid those same people are going to continue to drive, and then we're putting an uninsured driver. I mean, I'm thinking someone hits you, and you now have somebody who doesn't have insurance and no driver's license. And that's a great punishment for them, but you're also punishing some other people who might be recipients of those accidents. And that's the only concern. I don't know. I'm just being concerned about that. I wonder if maybe even Senator Tarnow might want to respond to that. His experience is...
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think this is intended to be more of a threat than under anything else. Put a notice inside of an establishment if you're tempted by purchase this, and then the majority of these kids are going to say, hey, wait, I don't want to get fined for that.
I'm just curious on the other part. Is that, do you find many youngsters who have had licenses suspended continuing to drive?
Not if your parents are on top of the issue, no.
I think the other effect this would have is it won't be taken seriously until the first person loses his license and boom. And then when that happens,
yeah,
the word will go immediately to all friends, families, relatives, and that's
more of the deterrent effect that wants to accomplish.
I'm supporting that bill. I just was curious about that.
Mr. Ockley. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Ockley representing Fred Meyer, Safeway, Rite Aid, and the Oregon Neighborhood Stores Association. All are responsible retailers, tobacco products, all have good, competent in-house training programs related to the sale of tobacco products, and all encourage the adoption of this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I should say one thing. I also represent R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. R.J. Reynolds Tobacco does not have a position on this bill, but I think that's important that you should know I also represent that company.
Likewise, Mr. Chairman, I represent United States Tobacco, who is neutral, has no position on this bill.
The committee is not surprised by that.
Mr. Novak,
why don't you stay close by, and I understand there will be some opposition to this, and we'll allow you to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Novick, representing Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, which is the Cancer, Heart, and Lung Association. These amendments weren't on the table, so I haven't had a lengthy amount of time to review them, although it's at that point in the session when you see four lobbyists for the tobacco companies huddled around paper in the hallway, it makes sense to be around. call me paranoid, just because you think people are out to get you, perhaps they are. I would suggest before adopting this that you might want to consult with the health division. One of the ways that compliance for sales to minors is dealt with is through sting operations, attempting to have people under 18 try to buy tobacco. We, in fact, received funding from the federal government through the sign-up amendment to do that. I don't know the implications of this amendment on that, and I would suggest that perhaps consulting with the health division about potential loss of federal funds before we do this would be appropriate.
I'm in 1994, and in the interim, I was on a committee that dealt with the Fine Art Agreement, and it was named after a representative, I think, out of Oklahoma. And in order to receive some federal funds through the Department of Human Resources, you had to do what are called sting operations. And there were a set of rules, and if you didn't comply, you would lose funding. And in 93, there was a huge brouhaha of who would do it, how it would be done, how do you pay for it, because, of course, you had to do them, but there was no money attached to it. And so finally, that was ironed out, and the idea of the sting operation was usually you're using someone who is underage to go in and try to make a purchase. And your large grocery stores did a very good job training personnel, having cigarettes located where it's hard to purchase, et cetera. Some of your convenience stores, your gas stations didn't do as good a job. But the fining was like $500 or something like that if you made a sale and it went up exponentially. Then Mr. Feiner lost for re-election a few years ago, and I think portions of his amendments have been repealed, but when I worked on those amendments to make sure that we didn't lose our funding, I can't recall anything that would cause these proposed amendments to be in violation of those. And in fact, one of the things we discussed was how to make it more of a deterrent for young people to buy cigarettes. In other areas, when we talk to law enforcement and drug out alcohol type activities, they say the best influence they have is someone's driver's license or their car. That really seems to get their attention. So I think the intent of the amendments could actually make that more effective. Here's what the chair would like to do today is go ahead and adopt amendments and move it. If you would contact the health division, see if they have concerns about it. If they do, then we can pull it back on a vote of reconsideration from the floor, send it to conference committee. But my committee is supposed to wrap up next week, and so I'd like to go ahead and move the bill. But are there questions for you? If there are questions for any of these, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bill is before us on our reconsideration, and I would I think I first have to move to
We are in work session. So I would move the dash 10 amendment, A10 amendment to House Bill 3492. Discussion? Objection? Chair then would move House Bill.
We need to remove the ALM.
I now have to re-adopt it because we reconsidered our vote on the bill. Thank you. All right, then I would also move the adoption of the A11 amendments. These were the amendments we adopted earlier today from the Attorney General's office. Discussion? Objection? And the Chair would move House Bill 3492 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? And we have three. Would you still carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Courtney will carry. All right. All right. We'll now go into work session on House Bill 2805. And this is a bill that and your large grocery stores did a very good job training personnel, having cigarettes located where it's hard to purchase, etc. Some of your convenience stores, your gas stations didn't do as good a job. But the fining was like $500 or something like that if you made a sale and it went up exponentially. Mr. Steiner lost for re-election a few years ago, and I think portions of his amendments have been repealed, but when I worked on those amendments to make sure that we didn't lose our funding, I can't recall anything that would cause these proposed amendments to be in violation of those. And in fact, one of the things we discussed was how to make it more of a deterrent for young people to buy cigarettes. In other areas, when we talk to law enforcement in drug alcohol type activities, they say the best influence they have is someone's driver's license or their car. That really seems to get their attention. So I think the intent of the amendments could actually make that more effective. Here's what the Chair would like to do. Go ahead and adopt amendments and move it. If you would contact the Health Division, see if they have concerns about it. If they do, then we can pull it back on a vote of reconsideration on the floor, send it to Conference Committee. But my committee is supposed to wrap up next week, and so I'd like to go ahead and move the bill. But are there questions for you? If there are questions for any of these, thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Bill is before us on our reconsideration, and I would think I first have to move to. We are in work session, so I would move the dash 10 amendment, A10 amendment to House Bill 3492. Discussion? Objection? Chair then would move House Bill.
We need to remove the ALM so we can carry the amendment.
Both want to adopt those.
Just to re-adopt them.
I now have to re-adopt it because we reconsidered our vote on the bill. Thank you. All right, then I would also move the adoption of the A11 amendments. These were the amendments we adopted earlier today from the Attorney General's office. Discussion? Objection? Then the Chair would move House Bill 3492 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? And we have three.
Senator Courtney?
Would you still carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Courtney will carry. All right. Mm-hmm. and we have that issue. Okay. All right. We'll now go into work session on House Bill 2805. And this is a bill that is challenging to the chair. And I had some questions, and I've asked Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council to come forward and address a few issues for me. So, David, if you would come forward. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. Judiciary is an afternoon committee, and I just can't break that habit.
We're getting to the end of session, so that's a good sign.
Yeah,
maybe.
There were some Dash 9 amendments that were proposed, and that led to a discussion about immunity. Right, and Dash 9, the committee won't consider today because they actually have no practical effect. But could you discuss about a quasi-judicial proceeding and by a public body and what immunity there is or isn't there now?
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. The issue that was raised by the Dash 9 amendments when they came in was the extent to which statements made in a quasi-judicial proceeding are already protected under the law. And a quasi-judicial proceeding would be defined as a proceeding, for instance, before a local body, where there's an individual who has asked for perhaps a variance or some other thing that the local government's able to give them, and the local body is going to make a decision on that application. So it's like a trial. That's why they call it quasi-judicial, a trial in which an individual's rights or duties are going to be determined by the body. That's to be compared with, for instance, a truly legislative type proceeding in which there's no particular individual in front of the body, but they're going to make a legislative decision similar to the types of decisions you make that are generally applicable to all people. And there are, under the case law, not within the statute, but under the decisions of the courts, already immunities that are granted for statements made in proceedings before public bodies, both in quasi-judicial and in legislative and administrative type decisions made by local bodies. But they are different. They are slightly different. In a trial, in a truly judicial proceeding, a statement made by one party about the other generally has absolute immunity. Absolute immunity. And what that means is that you're totally protected in defamation in a civil lawsuit for a statement made in that proceeding. You may be in trouble for swearing under oath, for perjury, criminal type sanctions, but you're not going to be sued. And the reason they have that rule is to encourage in trials that there be free and open state ability to make statements without fear that you're going to get into defamation lawsuits, and there's, in addition, you already have the protection of the perjury laws that with the criminal sanctions, but they don't allow lawsuits between parties based on what's said in the judicial proceeding. Quasi-judicial proceedings, the type I just talked about, for instance, of variance applications, enjoy absolute immunity as well under Oregon case law. So if you make a statement in one of these proceedings, one of the cases we were just looking at a few minutes ago was an Oregon State Bar proceeding, where an attorney was up for discipline before the Oregon State Bar and made some statement about a doctor and got sued, and the court said no. The Supreme Court said no. You can't sue the attorney for the statement made in the doctor because it was made in the course of a quasi-judicial proceeding trying to determine whether you get to keep your license or not to practice law, and so you have absolute immunity. Now, the qualification even on absolute immunity is this. there are many cases, and we just took a look at a couple of them before we came down here, in which the courts have said that the statement does need to be relevant and pertinent to the proceeding. So there's always the possibility that someone might be able to come in and say, well, the statement you made really just didn't have anything to do with the proceeding before us. The courts have also said in these cases on absolute immunity that there's going to be a presumption almost in favor of relevancy. There's a strong judicial slant in favor of making a finding that it has something to do with the proceeding, so that there's this broad, fairly broad protection. But if you really do have a statement that's just totally nothing to do with the proceeding before you, in that case, you may actually have the possibility of getting sued.
Well, one distinction that that causes people then to be careful in their statements, in a judicial proceeding, you're under oath, you can't commit perjury, and you can't commit false swearing. In a quasi-judicial, generally you're not under oath. I'm not aware of any that are where you're placed under oath. So you wouldn't be guilty of perjury or false swearing. Is that correct?
Sure, Brian, that's correct.
So what is the remedy in a quasi-judicial proceeding if, in fact, you did knowingly lie?
My Senator Bryan, I don't think there is a remedy. I think that the policy there apparently to encourage free and open statements. For instance, in the Oregon State Bar case, frequently the scenario is with respect to complaints made about attorneys. And if there was the possibility of lawsuits for complaints about attorneys or doctors or, for that matter, any other profession, the policy there is to encourage people to report and not risk the possibility of lawsuits, even though there may be knowingly false statements made about the attorney or the doctor in the complaint process. And so there are certain things in a professional licensing situation where perhaps there are other policies involved as well.
So even if those statements in the quasi-judicial were liable as defamatory, the person who has been liable or detained would have no cause of action.
That's correct, Chair Bryant.
Now, if you gave an example in the bar proceeding, normally people are placed under oath in those situations, so there could be the possibility of at least false swearing and maybe perjury, correct?
Correct. Any time you're under testifying under oath, there's a possibility of false swearing.
I'm a little bit familiar with the case law dealing with professional hearing and taking away license. Is there a specific case then that applies those quasi-judicial proceedings to the land use area? Or is this just an assumption based upon the generalities of the cases you reviewed?
Chair Bryant, there are cases where they have applied them to local proceedings. One of the ones we looked at, I looked at just a couple of days ago, related to, I believe, the siting of an airport where statements were made and seemed to be very close and on point to the issue here. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, before I get down to the dash line and what it was proposed, is that one thing you do need to understand under the existing law about statements made in even legislative proceedings at the local level is that they do enjoy some immunity now under the law. They have what's called a qualified privilege to distinguish it from the absolute privilege you've got in a judicial proceeding. The case law on those things, there's clear case law that indicates that qualified privilege exists. The problem with the case law is that there's trying to figure out how you get past that qualified. There seems to be a lot of ways to get past a qualified privilege. Some of the cases say, the older cases simply say, well, once you establish you have a qualified privilege, the burden shifts to the person suing you to show that you made the statement with actual malice, which is a term we've talked about before. But if you look at the Restatement of Torts, which is a kind of a treatise-type gathering of statements of law that our courts frequently follow, you'll find that there are about four different ways that you can lose qualified privilege. So, and as a matter of fact, when I was in private practice, I was involved with a with the defamation case that went up to the Court of Appeals and involved qualified privileges and defamation. In that process of doing that case, I learned there are a lot of different ways you can lose qualified privilege. So turning to the bill, with respect to removing quasi-judicial proceedings, the question that was presented to me was whether or not that would, by having that in the bill, if that changes the existing law with respect to quasi-judicial proceedings before local bodies. The bill as it now stands conveys absolute immunity for statements made that are material to the proceeding. So in that respect, that basically restates what the law is now for quasi-judicial proceedings, absolute immunity. It then goes on to say, even if it's an immaterial statement, that there is some protection, because if it's immaterial, it says you can get sued only if it was knowingly false. And that's a little different than the existing case law with respect to absolute privilege, where if you lose the privilege, if you make a statement that's irrelevant, and the court finds that it's irrelevant, right now you're wide open underneath standard defamation law. So the debate there frequently in those cases come down to, does it have the privilege or doesn't it? And since that's a matter of law, that can be decided very early in the proceedings in a motion for summary judgment. You don't get to the jury. This one here, by adding quasi-judicial, the effect of that would perhaps be to extend a little bit of additional protection, even beyond what you have underneath the absolute privilege currently conveyed, because you may have some additional protections even for irrelevant and immaterial statements. With respect to the other proceedings, the legislative administrative proceedings, this bill does make a very real change, because instead of having just a qualified privilege for those statements, which, as I said, can be attacked in any number of ways, many of which would get you to a jury, most of which would get you to a jury, instead this would convey basically absolute privilege for those statements that are at least material to the proceeding. And once again, that would be a question of law for the court that would probably get decided on a motion for summary judgment instead of by a jury.
I misunderstood your point about the quasi-judicial. If the quasi-judicial is wrapped into this bill, are you saying that this would strengthen some of the protections? I heard it both ways. Okay, strengthen the protections, but it would be more likely to have to go to a jury to figure out that it was strengthened?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, no, I think it would convey a little more protection than you currently have under the existing law for statements made in quasi-judicial proceedings, because generally what the bill does is the principal statement made by the bill is the same as existing law. You have absolute immunity for statements made in quasi-judicial proceedings as long as they're relevant to the proceeding. The bill probably takes you a step further on those by saying, and not only that, even though it's not relevant to the proceedings, not material to the proceedings, you may even have some protections for those statements, because the burden will be on the plaintiff to show that it was knowingly false at the time it was made. So it actually probably conveys a little bit of additional protection for statements made in quasi-judicial.
Okay, and this is going to
be right.
But would you say that in both proceedings that this bill would greatly increase the likelihood of a dismissal at the summary judgment level?
Chair Bryan, Senator Burdick, certainly in the legislative administrative type proceedings, not quasi-judicial, it would increase those chances, mm-hmm. because if you can show that you made it within the context of those proceedings, that's something that the court would decide. That issue is a matter of law that normally the court decides rather than the jury.
And with quasi-judicial, it wouldn't slow it down. It would just not change it that much. Is that what you're saying?
Senator Burdick, with respect to quasi-judicial, I believe that it might result in a few cases being where the defendant would win, but they wouldn't win underneath the current law. In other words, right now, as long as you can show that the statement made within the quasi-judicial proceeding was relevant to proceedings, you win anyway. And this bill doesn't change that. what this bill might change to some degree is statements that are made that are not necessarily relevant to the proceeding, but that you can show were not knowingly false, and then you're going to win on those as well. That would be an additional category of cases where the defendant would win.
So, Mr. Chairman, my question was not on the substance of it, if who's going to eventually win, but on the summary judgment stage. Is this going to increase, decrease, or leave the same the likelihood of summary judgment?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burke, I don't think it's going to change the likelihood that much on summary judgment for quasi-judicial proceedings, because, again, since they enjoy absolute immunity already, that you would win that under the current law in the same way you would win it under this law. The knowingly false thing is probably going to be a jury question that you're probably going to have to go to jury on anyway, so it probably is going to change the number of cases going to a jury.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Let me run a few by you. Qualified privilege, when does that apply?
Qualified privilege under the existing law applies to non-judicial or quasi-judicial proceedings in which public interests are involved, public meetings of those sorts. So your average city council meeting, you probably got a qualified privilege for statements you make before the council.
And the exceptions to the qualified privilege is when you have to show actual malice?
Actual malice, although, again, the case law in regular defamation has a list of about four different ways you can lose a qualified privilege, including such things as excessive publication. I haven't got them all off the top of my head, but if you look down through them, there are three or four different ways you can come in and establish that you abuse the qualified privilege. And I haven't seen many of those cases extended to these more local government type proceedings, but in the average defamation case where there's a claim qualified privilege, there's a long list of ways you can basically argue you abused the privilege and hence should still be subject to liability.
And does this go back to that New York Times case, Chair Bryant, in the U.S. Supreme Court, or is this an Oregon definition of qualified privilege?
Chair Bryant, this is as I said, a restatement of torts, which is national publication. There are many states that have adopted the qualified privilege standards in the restatement of torts, and Oregon has basically, by case law, said this is the rule we're going to follow. And I believe several other states have done the same.
But with this particular bill, we're not really talking about qualified privilege. We're talking about absolute immunity in quasi-judicial proceedings, correct?
Correct.
And so the discussion on qualified privilege, if this were adopted, would basically go out the window and we'd simply be dealing with the statute and what it means.
That's correct, Chair Brown.
The -9 amendments then, which I think you've seen in a draft, which did away with the application of immunity in quasi-judicial proceedings that basically have no effect because of the case law.
Chair Bryant, as I said, because under existing case law, quasi-judicial proceedings enjoy absolute immunity, removing them from the bill, the only thing that would change would be that little additional piece about irrelevant statements being a subject to suit. Right now, if you don't fall within the absolute immunity, if it's an irrelevant statement, you're wide open for a defamation action thereafter.
Then, turning to the bill itself, when we talk about material, we're looking at 9/11 and reading subsection 2, the immunity conveyed by this section does not apply to any statement of fact that is known to be false at the time the statement is made, and that is not material to an issue being considered by the public body as defined by ORS 3.260 gives us our definition of what is relevant material. Is that correct?
No, 30.
Public body.
That's public body.
So the definition of what's material, again, would be based upon the Oregon Evidence Code and case law. But if the statement's false and material. Then there wouldn't be absolute immunity in the way this is written. Is that correct? Or if it's false and immaterial.
Sir Ryan, if this provides protections within the context of these proceedings, even for statements that are knowingly false, as long as they're material to the proceeding, in the same way that you have that protection in quasi-judicial and judicial proceedings. So it would extend those same protections to these types of proceedings. The only exception here is if it's immaterial, and under an absolute privilege analysis, an immaterial statement would probably just render you subject to suit under the standard rules of defamation. This will actually add a little more protection and say you're going to have, even if it's immaterial, you have to make it knowingly false in order to get sued for it.
Well, from a public policy standpoint, that's where the chair has problems. Why would you want to allow or encourage false statements?
If I could just comment on that, I think the relevance of materiality here is that if it's knowingly is something that has to be determined by a jury, and the whole purpose of this legislation is to keep things from getting into the court system. But materiality, these statements don't occur in a vacuum, and if something is material, then you have everybody at the table and people with an opportunity to dispute the false material and to make their case as well. Whereas if something immaterial kind of comes out from left field, or it's a personal slander, a business slander, whatever, the same opportunity doesn't exist to refute it. The whole purpose of these events, these hearings, is to be a free marketplace of ideas where all sides can come in. So if someone comes in and they say something that's not quite true, it's up to a court to determine whether it's knowingly, but we need to err in the direction of protecting people's speech in these settings so that they don't end up in the court system. The purpose of this bill, as I see it, is not to make judgments on who's guilty or innocent, but to keep to err in the direction of allowing full and free public discussion. So who's to know? If someone says that, you know, this development is going to have 500 trucks going by every day and the actual number is only 400, you know, who's to say whether that person knew that it was only 400 and said 500 deliberately? But the purpose of it is the other person has the ability to come in and say, no, we have research. It's only 400 trucks a day.
But let's say that, given your situation, the person who made the statement that it was going to be 500 trucks a day knew it was false. Was just flat out lying because they didn't want the project to go forward.
Right. And see, that is, that's not a good thing. But the point is that we're balancing things here. In order to determine whether they knew it, you have to go into the court system, into a jury, present evidence. Everyone has to hire lawyers. So what we're doing here is I don't believe that we are endorsing people going in and throwing whoppers in public meetings. What we're doing here is that we are erring, we are directing policy towards free discussion. We are trying to take the chilling effect that these flap suits have caused. We're trying to take away that chilling effect. And I don't think it's in any way an endorsement of people not telling the truth. I think there are other ways to deal with those people. I've been in other public settings, and very quickly the people who you can't trust, the people who come in and lie, they very quickly lose their influence in any kind of a public process because the lies become uncovered, and those people generally in the normal course of things become very ineffective because the system relies on truth. But the way you get to that truth is by a free exchange of ideas. You don't get to that truth by shutting out people who, in the interest of caution and economic self-preservation, are not going to speak up. even if they think it's true, because whether something's true or not is a matter of judgment. So the system that we have provides other mechanisms for uncovering lies. We don't need these suits to uncover lies.
What would be the remedy for the person who's trying to do something with their property that because of these lies loses a loan, can't develop it, there's a year delay? What should be that person's remedy against the person who lies?
Well, the person's remedy is to go into the process and show that it's a lie.
But by adopting this, you get into the materiality aspect of it. And that's what caused me concern. If you look at the Dash 810 amendments, these are amendments that I had drafted that are slightly different than the proposed bill. And the new language is subparagraph D of this that says the person making the statement, the immunity contained in the section does not apply, A, if the statement is a fact, is not material to any issue being considered by the public body as which is what the current proposal says. And then B, the person making the statement knew or should have known that the material, that the statement was false at the time the statement was made. Why I added that is, in other areas of civil law and tort law, we have a requirement that when people make a statement, that they do the basic research to determine whether or not what they said is true or if they had made the basic inquiry, they could have found out, so that you can't claim the defense of lack of knowledge because you didn't ask the question or do an investigation. And according,
so if a person makes this true, it's not material. You come under your amendment.
Right.
But you know, those kinds of words mean something to lawyers. They don't mean something to everyday type of people who come to school board meetings and city council meetings and county commission meetings and testify. I may say so. I mean, I don't mean to be overly technical with you, Neil, but the word material is sort of a term that we learned in law school, and to all the years I've spent on the county council and all the public hearings I've been through, Lord knows how many statements were made that really weren't on issue or on point, if I may say so, or weren't material, as you and I know what it is. And I don't know, I just, that's holding the right person, the everyday citizen, to a standard that I really don't think is fair, if you want to know the truth. Now, the false thing is one thing, but the materiality is something that, I don't know,
because the lies become uncovered, and those people, generally in the normal course of things, become very ineffective because the system relies on truth. But the way you get to that truth is by a free exchange of ideas. You don't get to that truth by shutting out people who, in the interest of caution and economic self-preservation, are not going to speak up, even if they think it's true, because whether something's true or not is a matter of judgment. So the system that we have provides other mechanisms for uncovering lies. We don't need these suits to uncover lies.
What would be the remedy for the person who's trying to do something with their property that because of these lies loses a loan, can't develop it, there's a year delay? What should be that person's remedy against the person who lies?
Well, the person's remedy is to go into the process and show that it's a lie.
But by adopting this, you get into the materiality aspect of it. And that's what caused me concern. If you look at the Dash 810 amendment, these are amendments that I had drafted that are slightly different than the proposed bill. And the new language is paragraph B of this that says the person making the statement, so immunity conveyed in the session does not apply, A, if the statement is a fact, is not material to any issue being considered by the public body as applied by so, which is what the current proposal says, and then B, the person making the statement knew or should have known that the statement was false at the time the statement was made. Why I added that is, in other areas of civil law and tort law, we have a requirement that when people make a statement, that they do the basic research to determine whether or not what they said is true if they had made the basic inquiry, they could have found out. So that you can't claim the defense of lack of knowledge because you didn't ask the question or do an investigation. Recording.
So if a person makes a material, it's not material. It becomes one of your amendments.
Right.
But you know, those kinds of words mean something to lawyers. They don't mean something to everyday type of people who come to school board meetings and city council meetings and county commission meetings and testify. I may say so. I mean, I don't mean to be overly technical with you, Neil, but the word material is sort of a term that we learned in law school, and through all the years I've spent on the film city council and all the public hearings I've been through, Lord knows how many statements you made that really weren't on issue or on point, if I may say so, or weren't material, as you and I know what it's for. And I don't know, I just, that's holding the layperson, the everyday citizen, to a standard that I really don't think is fair, if you want to know the truth. Now, the false thing is one thing, but the materiality is something that, I don't know, that's something judges and lawyers play around with, and law schools play around with. I'm not sure the everyday citizen is really that conversant with the word material.
Well, and that bill's already in, that word's already in the bill.
Well,
I guess I was, the reference if you can give me an example. Well, either one of you. You're lawyers. The two of you would probably give two examples. I got a third one here. She didn't compromise.
So, Brian, if I may be of assistance? Subdivision application, developer comes in, they go to a public meeting at where they're going to discuss whether or not they get the permit to build it. A citizen comes in and says you should never let this developer build out there, and not only that, he cheats on his wife. Totally immaterial and irrelevant to the proceedings before the board, defamatory. If it's knowingly false, probably subject to suit under the bill. Said to harm the person, probably actual malice involved. That's the type of statement that probably
is not... Yeah. How about one? Well, they shouldn't be allowed to develop out there because they don't live out there. They don't have any idea of the impact. They live in Turner, and this is in the hills of West Salem, and they have no concept about, you know, they got to cut down all those trees and what that's going to do, such a, or they don't even live out there. Therefore, and I'm not sure that that's... They don't live out there. They don't get into cheating lives and things. Let's just say they don't live out there. They don't live out there. They've never developed from West Salem before. By their own admission, they've only driven there a couple of times. That was a little infield football game. They went on Wallace Road out there and just didn't play PLU. That's not material. It's not material. If the developer never, he really doesn't have any of that. I think you could, you know, you're going like that, but you're sort of saying, yeah, all right, there's materiality. Maybe there's a white sheet and all that stuff. And I don't think you should hold anybody So they make a statement like that. I don't think they should be prosecuted or defend or be run into the harassment because they make statements like
that.
Well, Mr. Chair, supporting, it's like Dave said, you go under a planning permit for an application to develop 5 acres that's zoned R2 or one or whatever. And all of a sudden, someone says you can't do it because it's a wetland here. And yet, DEQ and LCDC both have issued statements that there is no wetland on that property. But someone testifies in front of the planning commission that it is a wetland. Does that cause a problem for the developer? Does that cause a problem for the person who wants to flip the property?
What would happen in that situation?
Well, Chair Bryant, Senator Tarnow, you know, facts like that seems to me that either it is a wetland or it isn't a wetland and really are susceptible of easy determination by checking with the correct sources and seeing whether or not it's true. I guess, you know, when you look at the standard that's laid out in the bill as it now stands, basically, this picked out of air. This is the standard that's in the statute now for legislative committees, where, again, people coming before legislative committees are not under oath, and yet they have basically a license to lie, if you wish, because the idea being that wise members of the committee are going to stare at them out, and there are going to be other people in the process who are going to come forward and say, you know, if the issue here was, as the legislature over time has gotten more involved on occasion in individual cases, you know, was it a wetland or wasn't a wetland, this is something that should be able to be determined through the usual process. But so I think that would be definitely material, probably. It might be a lie, but under this bill, it would be protected.
Okay, how about this situation? Again, a planning issue, and the person testifying against the project, the material relevant testimony about their concerns, and says the city or the county shouldn't approve this because this developer in the past has broken this promise, has not lived up to his bonding requirements, hasn't paid his suppliers, his laborers on time, and we just don't want to further this type of enterprise as long as she's involved in. How would that fit?
Senator Bryant,
is it true or not true?
It's not true.
Okay.
And it's protected, I would say, under the bill, as it now stands.
As it now stands, that would
now stands that it's that is clearly protected.
There's a dash A8 in them, which is trying to see the problem with. And it talks about the immunity conveyed in this section does not apply to any statement of fact that is known to be false at the time the statement is made or that is made with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the statement. You familiar with that amendment?
Yeah, that's Chair Sparks.
Could you describe to the committee the impact of that?
As I indicated in the introduction, the statements made in these proceedings now have a qualified immunity. And basically, you know, the burden shifts to the plaintiff, the person suing you, to show that you did it with actual malice. One of the things I would presume that the court would look at in determining whether or not you had actual malice is whether or not you knew it was true or not. I don't think that's the only thing, and I'm not sure that the fact that you knew it was false at the time it was made would necessarily get you to the level of actual malice. So the effect of this language might very well be to provide you with less protection than you currently have under the law for false statements made in one of these proceedings.
Sorry, Dr. Mr. Chair, using your example, is one of the concerns that, okay, that comes out in a public meeting, that information is published in the newspaper the next day. In the meantime, the developer comes back and has able to lay out everything that this is not true. It's a concern that he has been damaged, even though he's now cleared as far as this committee is concerned.
he's damaged in the eyes of the people out there. Is that a concern? Is that
that would be this particular A8 amendment would allow them a cause of action for that damage statement if you show actual malice and maybe if you have the requirements that where the person who made those statements did it with the intent of harm, knew or should have known that they were false at the time that they were made and didn't care about taking that due diligence was made in public. Which is the publication requirement of defamation. And then the issue would be proving the plaintiff has to prove the actual malice and then what damage that caused him or her.
Then, Mr. Chairman, there's another remedy. I mean, that your scenario assumes that the people on the public body are just sitting there. If somebody came to me and said that, I'd say, okay, you bring the documentation back. You can make a statement like that. You bring your documentation back. I think public office holders are obligated, whether they're appointed or planning commissions or whatever, are obligated to try to get to the truth. And I think that's the remedy. And if someone came to this committee and made a comment like that, I can't imagine that any member of this committee wouldn't say, you know, that's an inflammatory statement. I want to see your evidence. And if you don't see that evidence, then that person's credibility is ruined. That's the remedy, not the lawsuit. With the New York Times standard, which is the -8 amendment, again, it takes a jury and it takes a court to determine somebody's state of mind, whether they knew it or should have known it or reckless disregard. That is a state of mind that you have to get into the court process. This is with all the lawyers and all the time commitment, and it would have a showing effect on free discretion. There are other remedies.
But you see, by granting the absolute immunity, though, those other remedies, you might win your battle in front of the planning commission because the person's lost his credibility. But your ability to recover damages for the defamation would be limited.
So, Mr. Chairman, if the defamation is refuted and the person who's lied is shown to be a liar, then is there truly defamation?
It could be a question then for the judge, the jury, whether or not there has been damage. That if it was published in the newspaper, radio, and TV, those sorts of things, that does have some harm to the individual person.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if there's defamation of that magnitude to somebody's good name and the paper publishes their remedies under libel law, using New York Times standards.
Well, but all the newspaper has to do is just say what was reported, not taking the position on it themselves. Before they can, the fact they have made an error in their reporting, they can run a retraction.
They can run a retraction, but they are also under, the truth is not a complete defense under libel law. So if the person can show that the newspaper knew it was false or should have known it was false or was in reckless disregard, then they could have an action. I mean, the retraction is important, but the truth is only a partial defense under Oregon libel law.
Well, it depends on how they're reported or editorialized.
Just look at the -8, and your scenario was a pretty strong scenario. I guess what I'm asking is, do you see the opportunity to take -8 for frivolous kinds of lawsuits with harassment to delay? Is that possible right there?
Well, in 95 we tried to do something in the way of frivolous lawsuits by expanding the prevailing fee and allowing a recovery of attorney's fees and costs up to an additional $5,000 at the request of the party that was sued. We also, in this session, have strengthened the summary judgment procedure so that people can dismiss frivolous lawsuits and counterclaims after. So there is a remedy that exists now for the frivolous But it's still, the unfortunate part is, for those who have to defend those actions, it still requires you to hire an attorney, finally answer, file your motion for summary judgment, and go through that hearing. It costs several $1,000. But there is the opportunity to recover that from people that have filed the lawsuit. Senator Courtney, if I'm just curious, are you saying that if someone makes a knowingly false malicious statement, they're protected by this legislation?
Chair Bryant, Senator Courtney, as long as it's relevant to the proceeding house, which is, it's the standard used in these hearings as well.
So if it's material, you're protected, even though it's knowingly made and false under the proposed law. If it's immaterial, you're not protected.
Mr. Chair, have we had a problem in the legislative study? I mean, we hear a lot of strange things, I know.
Yeah.
We respond strangely.
And I think the reason for that is it's the legislative process. And,
you know,
and it's a knowing free-for-all when you come in here. And it has the absolute immunity, just like it also does when we speak on the floor of the Senate or on the floor of the House.
I would hasten to add, Chair, that I have never made a knowingly false statement.
I'm sure we are. We all read it.
Sure. Yes. Is that an accurate statement?
Senator, stop using Senator Torno.
Mr. Chair, I think what we're trying to do is to establish good public policy. To make it clear. I'm just wondering, it doesn't make sense to me to allow somebody to come in and testify in front of a committee of people. City Council, County Board of Commissioners, anybody else, knowing this lie. And I think what we're trying to do is just establish good public policy to, but you can't do that. We don't want you to lie into this body, then we're stuck as a committee. So I guess the truth is a number of those things, and that takes time as well. I look back from the British point of view that, you know, a city council can then go out and require the truth to be ferreted out, if you will. But why should a person testifying in front of the city council be allowed to lie in the first place?
But Mr. Chairman, to come back to that, basically what the public policy here is to make people feel safe in giving their information, that they are not going to be sued. Because even if they're right, even if they didn't lie, they weren't malicious, it's a volatile situation, they might have very compelling truth that they're telling, but if they know that they're going to get sued, then it's going to stifle their ability, because it's only a jury and a court that can determine whether they're lying. I think the remedy is for city councils and for us and for everyone to send the message out as they're considering these issues. If you lie, you lose. That's the remedy. And the remedy is not to send the message out that, you know, if you come in, you better have all your information in order, because if there's one little thing, a line, and we can show that you should have known that, then man, you're going to be up a creek, you're going to be in court, you're going to spend $20,000 in attorney's fees, you're going to duke it out, and maybe you'll win.
I guess my question is, I put that in the statute for him. I can't put it in the statute if you lie.
But see, the problem is a lie is a matter of opinion, and it's a matter of judgment. And it's a matter of state of mind. And the only way you can get to the bottom of that, really, is with a jury and a court. The whole purpose of this legislation is not to dictate what people do or don't do in front of public bodies. It's to make people feel safe to come and participate. People feel unsafe with these suits looming out there.
Well, the public policy is you want people to come and express their opinions and take part in the quasi-judicial proceedings, but you also want them to tell the truth.
and not only lie, but do your homework before you make statements. And if you do lie knowingly, you want to still allow a cause of action for the person that's been harmed. And right now, those are the two competing public policies.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Henderson just made Section 6. It deals with some kind of... if you've got a case, Dave, where a person brings a definition to under the current law, where they're liable for attorney's fees and certain damage if you lose the dispute. Can you talk to us a little bit about Section 6? Is that also that they apply to a defamation case if a person loses?
Sure, Brian, you're going to have to help me. Subsection 6 says I don't have a copy of the bill.
Why do you have the
attorney's fees? Attorney's fees issue, dude.
Oh. Yeah.
If we could let those out, that would be.
Excuse me, Chair Ryan, Senator Tarnal. What this does is also intended to discourage lawsuits of this type, because under current law in defamation actions, generally you do not have a right to recover attorney fees from the other party. If I'm sued for defamation by somebody and I win eventually, basically, I bear my own costs and they bear their own costs. Senator Ryan, all the loser pay bills that we've drafted over the years knows that that's always been an issue about one in what cases attorney's fees should be awarded. But right now, basically, unless you can point to a statute that says you have a right to recover attorney's fees, you do not. So this section would be basically, subsection 6 is basically designed to encourage people suing when they should realize that the immunity provided by this section would apply.
Well, committee, a good discussion today. I think what I will do, we go into session and we go to caucus in 15 minutes. I'll reschedule this for Thursday for further
review.
Yes, it does, because it does the word and. Just a second, David. Senator Courtney and I are having a discussion here. It's just this is on line 10 and 11 on the issue of materiality and immateriality. Can you take that one more time?
Immunity doesn't apply. It takes the data from immediate protection doesn't apply.
And
if it's not material.
So it's going to be both things?
Both things. Because of the and.
In order for
the
immunity to apply. Yeah.
Is it sure today?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
We're talking about when the immunity does not apply, it has to be false and not material.
So maybe I'm dense, but I don't see, what's the difference between your A10 and the existing? If it's an and those two standards, I don't know or should have known.
I agree the standard, no or should have known on the subsection.
Oh, it's going to be, oh, should have known, okay.
So, except for the word and, the bill, someone intentionally comes in and lies, knowing it's not getting into a jury decision. They know fault. They do it with malice, and they lie. We have no problems with the bill over that issue. Is that right? You don't want them to have it. Is that right? Right. That's it. I don't want them. Whether or not the issue is material or immaterial, I don't want to encourage people on it. So that, I mean, I don't think, I have trouble with your views on material. I don't want to hold people that said it. We held that discussion earlier, right? You know, you might not agree with me, and I respect for you to agree with me. I don't think it's fair to hold them to some, you got to say something's material, but I don't want to get into that. I don't think it's fair to hold the public to a material standard that they don't understand, only lawyers understand. The intentional lying, knowingly, not, they thought they had it right. They knew they had it wrong. They knew they were going to lie, and it was done with malice. But you know the word malice, here you are talking like lawyers. That area, that one bothers you in the system.
Right.
You also want to talk about it. So, right? Am I right?
Right. And what I said knew or should have known.
Well, yeah. Okay. All right. Here we go. Lawyer, again. No, I should have known. I don't want to be as tight as you do on that, because these are everyday people who, you know, they should have known that the developer knew more about the property than they suggested, because you travel up there 2 or 3 times. I don't want to get into that. I just think they got to know. They knew it was a lie. Done with malice. And so, okay. I'm getting a very good picture where you're coming from. Right? Obviously, you're not going to let the bill go out today, right?
No, we'll come bring it back Thursday.
Where's Kurt? I'm going to talk to Schrader when he's gone.
He's standing back there. All right, thank you, David. You might schedule some time for yourself on Thursday morning. Well, I closed then the work session on 2805. The committee will go for a few more minutes, and then we need to go to our respective
dinner work.
Brian Bowles amendment on this trip.
Yeah, right.
What are you doing?
Brian knows what to have that.
Yeah, we do have it. Our last work session that I think we'll get today is probably on 2417. Brian Bowles, he's come forward. We'll see.
I'm just trying to wonder if you're going to be on the still move.
Well, we adopt the ship we're having here. So they steal us in a new bill. We might get yours too, just depends on the time.
Hey, Bo. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this morning representing the National Association of Independent Insurers. A couple of weeks ago, you had a preliminary hearing on House Bill 2417. And at that time, the committee received a letter from Chip Lazenby, the legal counsel of Governor Kitzhaber, who urged the committee to amend the A. N. Gross bill to include a provision for an inadvertent or unintentional lapse, which is in the current, the A. N. Gross version of the bill, at 30 days. Mr. Lazenby's suggestion was to take that to 180 days. With our clients, and while we felt the original provision was workable, it is important to the governor at this point. It becomes important to us. And,
that's not true. The Republicans are sure.
Yeah, you guys. It's true to me.
So the dash A5 amendments, which I have here, and so to get to the first.
I think A4 or A5.
A5. And they are rather straightforward. They simply delete 30 and insert 180 days.
Committee, as we are looking at these, there were two other amendments proposed, the A2s and the A3s. One of them has a potential impact and a constitutional question dealing with gas tax and how you can use the gas tax money. So for purposes of simplicity, I don't want to adopt those. I will move the A5 amendment to House Bill 2417. Discussion? Objections ordered. Chair then would move House Bill 2417 as amended for due pass. Discussion? Report of the note. Senator Cordy is a no.
Well, Nelson's a no half the time. I just can't see no.
He's a yes today.
And you're not a doctor yet,
sir. I'm doctor. Motion passes. I'll go ahead and carry the bill. We have a few minutes. Let us then go to 2758. I'd like to see Lori and Phil Donovan and Lori to come forward. Did Chief Corey just step out? Could you,
We'll see. How many travelers are going to be on this? Still no?
Well, we adopted the ship lines and using it. So, they feel that it's through Phil. We might get yours too, just here for retirement.
Hey, Bo. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bo, and I'm here this morning representing the National Association of Independent Insurers. A couple of weeks ago, you had a preliminary hearing on House Bill 2417. And at that time, the committee received a letter from Chip Lazenby, the legal counsel of Governor Kitzhaber, who urged the committee to amend the A. N. Gross bill to include a provision for an inadvertent or unintentional lapse, which is in the current, the A. N. Gross version of the bill, at 30 days. Mr. Lazenby's suggestion was to take that to 180 days. I served with our clients, and while we felt the original provision was workable, it is important to the governor. At this point, it becomes important to us. And,
that's not true. The Republicans, but it's true.
Lobby, you guys.
No, it's true to me.
So the dash A5 amendments, which I have here and failed to give to the clerk.
Actually, A4 is A5.
A5. And they are rather straightforward. They simply delete 30 and insert 180 days.
Committee, as we are looking at these, there were two other amendments proposed, the 8s and the 8s. One of them has a potential impact and a constitutional question dealing with gas tax and how you can use the gas tax money. So for purposes of simplicity, I don't want to adopt those. I will move the A5 amendments to House Bill 2417.
Discussion?
Objection ordered. Chair then would move House Bill 2417 as amended for due pass.
Discussion?
Court is allowed.
Senator Courtney is a no.
Well, that was a no half the time. I guess you have three no.
But he's a yes today.
And you're not a doctor.
I'm a doctor. Motion passes. I'll go ahead and carry the bill. We have a few minutes. Let us then go to 2758. I'd invite Steve Corey and Phil Donovan Corey to come forward. Did Steve Corey just step out? Could you? Okay, fine. Why don't you record then? Okay, why don't you have not had option to testify the original bill?
ATC did not on the original bill.
Why don't we have you go first, then we'll allow Mr. Ford to speak to his amendments, and then we'll talk about those amendments. You can identify yourself for the record, please.
Senator Bryant, the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Cato. I represent Associated General Contractors. ATC is a commercial construction trade association representing about 1,200 members here in the state of Oregon, all aspects of the commercial construction industry here in Oregon. And I welcome the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2758-A amendment. This version of the bill is the result of a collaborative effort among several parties who were involved in both sides of a very contentious discussion about the lien law here in Oregon. We could not come to resolution on the original proposal that AGC put forward with the bankers. Therefore, we negotiated behind the scenes and came up with the one part of the bill that we could all agree on, and that was amended as the dash A that was passed over and which you see now in front of you. At the close of this collaborative process, all the parties agreed not to introduce additional amendments to the bill on the Senate side. We believe adding amendments at this point violates the intent of our parties, and our goal is to have all the stakeholders come together in the interim, review all aspects of the lien law, and come up with a collaborative process to take back to the next legislative session in 2001. We ask that you approve House Bill 2758 in its A and gross version.
A lot of people say we can't touch it.
Questions for this witness? Mr. Kafouri, and your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here representing the Architects Council of Oregon and the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. If anything happened on the way to passage to Senate Gov House Bill 2991, and that's the reason I'm here today. What you have before you in my amendments, which are the dash 4 amendments, are essentially House Bill 2991. What happened was that we had this bill in front of the House Committee, and there were some concerns about some of the amendments and some of the provisions of that bill. One of the provisions had to do with surveyors, and the feeling with the committee was that it was inappropriate to have that section in this bill, and so we took it out in a separate bill, which the committee has presently. At that time, we were ready to have 2991 with that provision taken out of it, brought in front of the committee. There was a lobbyist who was happy with that, with the bill still, and I tried to find out what that problem was and could not find out my satisfaction. Finally had the committee couldn't find out. We finally got the lawyers from that lobby group and our lawyer together, and my lawyer said, you know, I don't think there is any difference. I can't find any matter of substance where we disagree with the opposition, and I don't think that their concerns really materially affect our section of the bill, which has to do with architect liens. I brought this information back to the chair. By that time, the time limit had run out. It was too late to get 2661 work session, so he suggested that I, this is Representative Lane Chatterley, suggested that I go to the AGC, who had introduced 2578, and asked to be on their bill. I went to Lori Long, and I said, I'd like to put an amendment on your bill. It does not affect your section of the law. It has no substantive effects on your industry. And she said, that's just fine. So I went ahead and had those amendments drafted. I was informed about a week or so ago, perhaps 2 weeks, that she was evidently overruled by her superiors, and that AGC was no longer happy to have my amendments on their bill. But again, the reason for that is just because this other group had gotten together and decided they like what they have. There's an interesting Aesop fable. You may recall about the dog that was in the manger, and the cow came and wanted some of the hay that was in the manger, and the dog barked at him and let the cows near. And the cow said, why are you doing this? You can't eat the hay. Why are you unhappy about us getting to it? And then if I may say, I think we have a little bit of the same situation, Mr. Chair, going here right now. If I can tell you a little bit about what our amendments do.
Can't wait to hear the response.
I think we have.
If I can tell you a little bit, Mr. Chair, what our bill does. Our amendments do not grant any new rights to lien anything. All they do is clear up ambiguities that have arisen in the statutes. We have long, as architects, been afforded lien rights and surveyors under ORS 87010. On account of fees earned in design, preparing design and construction projects, documents for contract and contract administrative services with respect to real property improvements. In 1981, this right was
extended to services intended for use in those which are for buildings which were, for one reason or another, not constructed. This happens not infrequently when someone's financing falls through. They've hired an architect, the plans are all drawn, we spend a lot of time and money getting the plans ready to go. The financing falls through, and the developer says, well, I'm back to California, and our folks are left holding the bag. The problem with the law as it is written right now is that there are many inconsistencies and unclarities in the law, and the law calls for the person who files a lien and fails to perfect it has to pay the office of site attorney's fees, which in many cases could be more than you lost in the original architect fees. So you could win your case, have the other side owe you with architect fees, but you have to pay more attorney's fees than you lost. So our attorney has advised most of his architect clients not to try to file survey or architect lien because the dangers are too great. And what we have, I can go through the details of what our bill does, but our amendments, what they do is take out those inconsistencies, make the clarities so that the lien which we have had for a long, long time becomes usable. It does not affect the other folks in any slightest way. And to emphasize that point, I made the offer, Mr. Chair, early on, long time ago, early in the session, to the other committee. I said, if you can find some specific concerns in our amendments, in our bill, that would clarify your problem, if you think you have a problem, we're still not convinced that they have a problem, then we'd be happy to make those amendments. And like I said, at this point, it's too late in the House. I will take those over to the Senate. I will give you my word of honor that I will not pass the bill out without those amendments being made. That offer was rebuffed, and which says to me that there was not a sincere, good faith concern with our amendments, and otherwise they would have made an attempt to at least allow us to talk about amending them in such a way it would suit them. So we are now following Representative Shetterly's advice about bringing this amendment to your committee, and I hope that you adopt them.
The, under the existing law, you can contact and complain to me. And I'm just confused with my one statement. If you prevail on your lien, your time will recover attorney's fees under existing statute.
That's correct. The problem is, Mr. Chair, that it's very difficult to prevail on the lien because there are inconsistencies and ambiguities and legal traps which make it likely that you may not. And because of that, then you may end up winning the suit in terms of, and this has happened, you win the suit for the architect's fees, which are $5,000, but you didn't you lose on the lien. The lien was not perfected, and so you owe attorney's fees for $25,000 to the other side.
Well, but that would only be if for some reason you didn't have the right to lien, or you didn't perfect it properly.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the problem. The perfection is the concern, and that's what our amendments do, is to make sure that those...
specifically... were you having trouble with the existing law that didn't allow the perfection?
Well, first of all, design service, let me just read this, that I may perform for a person or entity other than the record owner of the property upon which the construction is planned. The statute provides that services for which a lien may be claimed must be performed for the owner or the owner's agent. The client's status as agent is often unclear and will most certainly be disavowed and disputed if the designer claims a lien. Secondly, statutory lien language creates uncertainty as to when the designer's professional lien arises and when it expires.
But if you're able to show that, in fact, the agent was the agent of the owner and you have natural or apparent authority to bind the owner, you wouldn't lose the lien.
Mr. Chair, but that's the problem. And this what this does clear that up.
How does it clear it up?
Because
it's the same. What I see, that this bill does, it includes surveys, which before may or may not have been included because of, unless you could put it under specification or other services.
Mr. Chair, if I may interrupt, the survey issue is merely cleaning up a scrivener's error. That's not a new lien if you noticed earlier on, it talks about surveyors can claim these things, but doesn't say what they can claim them for.
Right, and I agree. That, to me, is just a clarification of what was
said by my legislative counsel.
And then it adds the word or supervision, and I understand what that means. That could, but as far as whether or not the person is the agent of the owner and allows you to claim the lien on the property, the existing law would still be the same. It doesn't change that.
Mr. Chair, I have to dig a little ignorance on some of the specifics. Our lawyer is in trial this morning, and I can dig through here and, you know, read language to you.
Why don't we do this, since we're all supposed to be in caucus right now? We'll be continuing this on Thursday morning. I don't think we can continue any time, but we're going to have to do that one more time.
So. And I will have to get our lawyer here if you'd like, Mr. Chair, to answer those more specific questions.
All right, because I don't understand.
Okay.
You haven't changed that portion of it.
Right.
And the other thing to consider is this will probably be an issue that we'll take up in the interim. To me, the real distinction between the two, where you guys, your real argument is, what your attorney doesn't want to build is it to be included in this portion of the statute. He wants it in the miscellaneous lien statute rather than the lien statute dealing with construction. That's the direction of his comments, and I think that's what his intended purpose is. And for right now, if we don't change the law, architects still claim the lien under the same section they do right now. So your amendments would continue the same. So that to me is at least what your memo argues about, where it would be most appropriate to have architectural and surveyor liens.
I would also say, though, Mr. Chair, that we have some specific concerns with the language, some undefined terms such as constructive improvement. It operates fine under improvements, but the term constructed has been asked. So there is some truth to what you're saying. There is some concern about the design professionals being under construction, and when it would make some sense to you otherwise, which would be something that we could tackle in the interim.
Well, the more complicated the issues are, more likely it's going to go to the interim, just because of the time. But we'll talk about it again.
Thank you. Yeah.